From Daylight and Media 3 Limited, I'm Kazuki Akiba.
I'm Tara Hori.
And this is a new season of Sayonara Baseball. This is a podcast where you and I find unseen baseball gems by analyzing them alongside different trends, news, and motivation behind many moves around the league today. And today, we will discuss the preview to the 2020 League Championship Series and what we think is the key to winning these series. And here to talk more about this is Brandon Weiser, a longtime colleague of mine. He's a business intelligence professional who's a Forbes Advisor contributor, as well as a man behind the Airline Guy blog. He writes his opinions on news in the airline industry.
He destroyed left-handed pitchers. Chapman, no regular lefty. 3-2, Brasso sends one into left field. Gardner going back, and it is up and gone! Mike Brasso has homered, and the Rays have a 2-1 lead. What a moment for Brasso. Tampa Bay on top on the 10th pitch of the at-bat.
Welcome back to Sayonara Baseball. I'm Kazuki, and with me here again is my longtime friend and colleague and baseball sensational expert, Brandon Weiser. Welcome back.
Thank you, sir. Thank you for having me back. Glad to be here.
First, before we begin talking about what happened in the past week with the division series and onto the championship, we want to talk about a moment of tribute of these two amazing baseball players.
Bob Gibson, who set a new National League record for earned run average this year, 1.12.
He's got it! Struck him out! Look at the scene on the field. McCarver, the first one. Now his infielders all over him.
He stands between Ford and one of his greatest triumphs. Benson lifts a soft pop fly to Kubek. The ball game is over and the Yankees win 2-0. Ford has his third straight World Series shutout, his eighth series victory for a new record, and he also is closing in on Babe Ruth's mark of 29 and two-thirds consecutive scoreless innings.
In the past week, on October 2nd, legendary St. Louis Cardinals pitcher Bob Gibson passed away. He was passed away as we were preparing for our podcast last week. And then yesterday on October 9th, the New York Yankees legend Whitey Ford passed away. And as we were discussing throughout the week, all these incredible pitching performances we were seeing from different teams, be it the Braves, the Dodgers, I reflected on what I had learned about Bob Gibson and Whitey Ford over the years. And originally, both of them I kind of picked up from, like, they were the name that everyone was compared to. When you look at performances of great pitching in postseason or in regular season. And I'll start with Bob Gibson, because my connection to Bob Gibson is learning about him through the calls of learning about Jack Buck. Jack Buck's the legendary broadcaster of St. Louis Cardinals, the father of Joe Buck, who's now the current broadcaster of the World Series on Fox. And when I read about Bob Gibson, I reflected on an article that I pulled up from MLB.com from Andrew Simon. And there's a clip from Bob Costas. Bob Costas got his big break in St. Louis. And what happened was I learned about these two incredible performances of Bob Gibson, one in the playoffs, one not in the playoffs. In the 1968 World Series, the Tigers were playing the Cardinals. Fast forward, the Cardinals lost this World Series to the Tigers. But in game one, Bob Gibson threw 17 strikeouts.
17 in a playoff game.
In a game one of a World Series, he threw 17 strikeouts. Now, if you look at Bob Gibson's postseason game log, he averaged over 9 games in the World Series, 9 innings per game. He threw 92 strikeouts and had an ERA below 2.
He pitched a complete game in all those games.
He pitched only one instance did he not pitch a complete game. He pitched 8 in the first game he ever pitched in the World Series in 1984 against the New York Yankees. He pitched after that 10-9-9-9-9-9. He pitched 10 innings in one game and beat the Yankees in game 5 of the 1964 World Series. So they're striking out 13. He gave up 17 earned runs in 9 World Series postseason games. I mean, this is outstanding. I mean, you listen to Bob Costas, about he was just intimidating. I mean, we joke about in our Forbes softball league about how it's intimidating to face our own pitcher.
Right.
And he's so good. But it's like, how could it be like people were like, you listen to interviews that he gave about people facing Bob Gibson after that, and he's like, you didn't want to face him. He was that good.
Gibson has accomplished just about everything a pitcher can in his brilliant career, but he has never pitched a no-hitter. He has one going here at Three Rivers tonight in the seventh inning. Fans are on their feet in anticipation. Bob Gibson working on a no-hit, no-run game. Willie Stargell standing between Gibson and the no-hitter. A pitch, swing, and a miss. He's done it. A no-hit, no-run game.
The no-hitter that he pitched, and I was listening to it a little bit back, I was like, oh, Bob Gibson's going to finish the game. There's no doubt in my mind Bob Gibson's going to finish games. And you hear about stories about Bob Gibson finishes games. And, like, that's an incredible feat. I mean, the postseason stats, this no-hitter that he pitched against Pittsburgh several years later, it's just incredible. And then we've transitioned to Whitey Ford, who, to me, was the other name on a Yankees game. You hear every great Yankees pitcher in the modern era that we all refer to, Andy Pettit, David Cone, David Wells. Like, they have to compare themselves against somebody. Whitey Ford. Whitey Ford, 33 2/3 scoreless innings in the postseason. I mean, like that's incredible. And what Whitey Ford did, I'm pulling up a great article to look up if you want to go read it from the New York Times from Tyler Kepner.
I did read that article. Yeah, like he just highlights the whole part about game 6 and 7 against the Pirates. Like,
and I, incredible, ironically, played at Forbes Field, which is on the site of where I went to grad school. Forbes Field was on a location which is now part of the University of Pittsburgh. Just hearing these stories, like, oh, Whitey Ford. Like the story about how, like, we're going to get into mismanagement in the World Series about pitching this year. And one of the most famous stories was the World Series against Pittsburgh in 1960, where the Yankees were playing at Pittsburgh and Casey Stengel, the manager of Whitey Ford, for the Yankees, does not pitch Whitey Ford in the first game, saves him for game 3, the home opener, and he just goes nuts and just pitches an amazing game. They go back to Pittsburgh, he pitches game 6, and then game 7, the Yankees lose.
Right, and it was close to 10-9.
Right, and had they pitched him in the succession that would have been strategically sound of what we would have expected, 1-4-7, he would have been there, and we never would have known. I mean, there's a group of fans, of historians and fans from Pittsburgh who every year will go out on October 8th and listen to that game, they'll still listen to the World Series at Forbes Field, like this giant field. And it's incredible to watch because you hear names like Whitey Ford and players that we would have never just dreamed to face today. It's incredible to listen to these stories. And I guess we'll end on one note that will tie this all back together. In that game on August 14th, 1971, Bob Gibson's no-hitter against the Pirates, starting third baseman, St. Louis Cardinals, Joe Torre. I mean, the connection between these two men just by like the 6-degree separation is just incredible. They're legends in their own right. They're both in the Hall of Fame for all the right reasons. I believe both of them are on the all-century team, or at least Bob Gibson is. I'm sure Whitey Ford is. As we talk about postseason pitching today, two emblematic stories of these great men in baseball. So as we recall the stories of the past week, we look back to what we saw, and I'm excited to get back into the stories of this week, remembering these two incredible performances and, like, I'm not sure anything ever top these in like the modern era.
Coming up after the break, Brandon and I recap the League Division Series as well as discuss the preview to the League Championship Series and who we think will advance to the World Series.
Edward Charles Whitey Ford, the man who won more games for the New York Yankees than any other pitcher in the team's history, announces his retirement at Yankee Stadium and says goodbye to the fans. A painful bone spur in the elbow of his famous left pitching arm prompts his decision.
As we dive into this week, We look at four series. We predicted some of them quite well. Some of those we did not.
I mean, there's some hit or misses, especially on my end, a lot of misses. But, you know, I'm excited to get into it and, you know, compare how they did to the legend. I mean, there are a lot of fierce pitching matchups, and that actually went pretty strong and well. Like, yeah, let's dive into that. But
which game would you like to start at? Do you want to start with the quickest and the shortest, which was the Braves Marlins?
Yeah, let's dive into the quickest and easiest recap to do, which I predicted completely wrong: the Braves and the Marlins series.
Yes, so the what Braves went and the Marlins.
Right and wrong there?
Well, the Braves and the Marlins. Well, what went right for the Braves was their pitching. I mean, they trotted out the two pitches that we expected: Max Fried, Ian Anderson, and then Kyle Wright. Kyle Wright came in game three.
A rookie.
Another rookie. The rookies shut out the Marlins. Max Fried had a little bit of a...
Five run. And then, like, I think there was like a whole blow up in the sixth inning where Braves scored like 9 runs real quickly.
That's what worked right in that for me in this series. I mean, the batting for the Braves, just Travis... Who would have thought we could have counted on Travis d'Arno, the DFA of the New York Mets, to go down to Atlanta and just, you know, hit a home run?
No, but he did have a revitalized career in Tampa, which probably fixed him. And then now he became a powerhouse name in Braves. And then, I mean, Freddie Freeman didn't do that much, or even Ronald Acuna. It's the B guys like Duvall, Swanson, even Albies are the ones who carry that whole offense. And d'Arno, who clearly should be probably that series MVP, like hit 500 and hit a lot of bombs and knocked in a lot of runs.
It was just amazing to watch the command and control of the Braves, both pitching and batting, throughout this entire series. Because, as we said last week, we had hoped the Marlins would put something together. And the Marlins scored runs, not in the seventh inning, which was good. But they led briefly in game one. And then
Alcantara came out and the bullpen blew up for them.
Right. Seventh inning, 6 runs. And that did him in, which was unfortunate because the Marlins curse has now officially ended.
Right.
They have now lost a series, but we'll see. I mean, the future of that team is very interesting because who will they bring in next time around? We don't know, kind of thing.
And if the Marlins ownership are changed, you know, the curse is that they're cheap, that they won't bring in anyone, but well, Jeter and like Sherman and company would bring in a big bat because that's what they honestly need is the bat. They have the pitching. Just a matter of who's going to really hit for them.
That's the real test. Is who's going to come in to do the justice that they need to keep that organization going.
Like you said, I think the big wild card, Starling Marte, he was not there. That definitely hurt them quite a lot.
That was a tough pill to swallow. If you just look at the nature of that team. They have power bats. They have good bats. But Starling Marte was that added bonus. They didn't have him. You get to rely on other players. You get to really depend on your pitching. And the pitching blew up in game one. Didn't have a great showing in game. In game two, they pitched quite well. But
yeah, Pablo Lopez, like 2 home runs, though. 2 solo shots.
That didn't help. In game three, Sixto Sanchez lost in the third inning. So...
Well, that's typical Sixto Sanchez, right? Last time when he faced the Braves, he also lost him in the third inning and shelled out a lot of runs. So that was the end of the Marlins.
I will say that the Ronald Acuna tweets about like what he did in the game where he
got hit by a pitch and whined about it.
We're back to that scenario again. Where that was this year, and that was last year. This year, that was ugly to watch that whole thing with Jose Urania.
Right,
I was not a fan about that. And then he tweeted the Damian Lillard bye wave as they won the World Series, as they won the series. I'm like, oh goodness gracious,
brutal.
Fueling the fire. You brought up Dansby Swanson, and Dansby Swanson hit a home run the first 2 games. Game one, game two, and then he hit a triple in game three. He said, the Braves have very good players at the top of their order. We both recognize that. Ozuna, Acuna, and Freddie Freeman. That bottom half of the order, when they step up, like a lot of these teams we're seeing in the playoffs, that's a show of experience, dedication, Brian Snitker. Just think, we're going to go out with these guys and we're going to play. And they did it.
And to be fair, these guys in the bottom half of the lineup, they've been in playoff contention for 3 straight years. So they have the experience and they know what to like go for and they understand what's at stake.
And they played well. The bullpen. I forgot the depth of the bullpen to a certain degree for the Braves.
Oh, yeah. They supplanted it like the past 2 years. Like, it's crazy. They brought in, you know, Shane Green from the Detroit Tigers, Melanson from the Giants, and Will Smith from free agency Giants again. And then you have one more guy I'm forgetting. Who was that main guy?
Webb, Minter.
Chris Martin. There we go.
Right.
Rangers.
I can only speak just watching Mark Melanson pitch when I lived in Pittsburgh. When Melanson came in as the closer in Pittsburgh before he kind
former
of had
Yankee.
Right. When Melanson came in before he had some off years and off settings, he was revered just like Mariano Rivera. Like, they played the Sharks on Mark. The Shark comes in, they put him into the game, shut him down, close the game. Pirates made the playoffs both the multiple years when I lived there. He goes away. He's able to revitalization a little bit. He comes to Atlanta along with Will Smith, who we know Will Smith was like highly touted, like trade deadline type of pickup. Like, he wanted to get moved and then he moved.
And then they just bought him a free agency for 4 years.
Right. And now they have closer, they have multiple closers on their roster, which you never know how it's going to work out with you have multiple closers in your bullpen. And they have found a way. I mean, we look at the Rays and how the Rays have stacked their bullpen in all these weird ways. The Braves have kind of done the same thing. Like, they have got 5 innings in you. Great. Just let the other guys go do their job. But to the credit of the Braves management, Kyle Wright pitched 6 innings. Max Fried pitched the least.
He's a supposed ace, but the rookies, like, they shut out offenses. If you look at even the Red Series, like, they just got shut out by rookies. They're just that dominant.
That's the truth. Like, if you look at it, it's just a simple 5-9, 9-5, 2-0, 7-0. Games over. And that was quick sweep for the Atlanta Braves. They move on to go to Arlington, where they'll face
the next opponent we're going to talk about from this series. We're going to talk about the Dodgers Padres. Well, that one was kind of, you know, easy. I mean, I think Padres weren't at full strength, unfortunately. So you can't really say that as much. Like, their pitching weren't there. They just got outmatched and outclassed by the Dodgers, who's just way too talented from top to bottom. Was only problem being the ninth inning, and you can't really say much about the Dodgers. Like, you just expected them to win.
We expect the Dodgers to win. We talked about that. I will say, what struck me in this series was what happened in game one. Right off the bat, they brought in Clevinger, and he pitched an inning and a little over two pitches.
Yeah. Second inning and 2 pitches. And he got injured.
And then he felt the pain in his arm. You can just watch like this dismay just wash over the face of the management, the managers and the bench for the Padres. Like, oh gosh, we have to do this again. Bullpen game. We don't want a bullpen game. We just did a bullpen game. They do a bullpen game.
Entire like half the series, right. The last series.
I didn't gel well. And the Dodgers took advantage of that in game one, winning 5-1. Game two was close. Zach Davies pitched marginally better than we thought he would.
But still, they still had to bring in their key bullpen arm and probably overused at this point. Stammen, Strom, and we're talking about Rosenthal, Pomerantz.
In game two, Zach Davies' line was 5 innings pitched for giving him 9 hits, 4 runs, all of them earned, no walks. 3 strikeouts and 1 home run. In that game, the bullpen was Pagan, Johnson, Pomerantz, and Dan Altavilla, former Mariner. You're leaning on too much on these guys. You're leaning way too much on these. Because in game one, Clevinger left. Johnson, Weathers, Adams, Hill, Garrett Richards.
He was a starter. You know, that's what I kind of wondered was their strategy. Like, you knew Clevinger was injured. Why push him so hard to come back to a series to get him injured again. He might even need a Tommy John at this point. Like, who knows, right? Why not bring in Garrett Richard, who was already the starter before he got pushed to the bullpen? Like, that was just a weird move by Padres.
Also in game one, Walker Buehler only pitched 4 innings.
And Dustin May came in 2 innings.
And then Gonzalez, Trinan, and Kenley Jansen finished him off. We didn't expect that, really. We'd expect Buehler to go deeper into games, more or less, when we were looking at kind of our preview.
But Buehler has the blister. He has that blister issue.
And we hope that never becomes an issue in the future. And then game three, Dustin May starts as the opener. And you go to the bullpen setting. But Urias comes in and pitches 5 innings, striking out 6. Great. That was a reverse of a plan, but it worked.
If you look at the stat line of 2020, Urias has trouble in the first inning. He just he's like a guy who needs to get in a rhythm. And I think it was a smart choice for him to bulk the rest of the game. And once he was bulking and was on, you know, Padres couldn't come back.
There you go. I would say the turning point, I'll bring this up now, and I'll bring up again. We talk about the Yankees series, that catch by Bellinger. And our listeners will know this, but you know this. For our softball team, I play center field predominantly, and I am known for making overly exaggerated catches. I'll call it very nicely. But I watched the tape on that catch. And I watched the tape on the Judge catch from game 5 of the AL division series against the Rays. When Bellinger went up to get that ball, it was center field, dead center. We'll talk about the specific. If they had scored, it would have been a grand slam. He robbed a grand slam in a playoff series.
From Tatis, too.
From Fernando Tatis. Wow, what a catch. One. The radio call from Charlie Stein and Rick Monday was incredible. That was, wow. It was like amazement. That is just the type of singular event that could turn a series. In the NHL Stanley Cup playoffs, they talk about the same thing. Like the captain of the Tampa Bay Lightning, Steven Stamkos, hadn't played a single game the entire playoffs. Comes in for 2 minutes and 47 seconds, scores a goal, never plays another minute. And the Tampa Bay Lightning somehow just come back and win the whole thing. It's like, you hate to boil it down to that, but like that motivational moment, it's like, we can do this. Cody Bellinger had like a so-so year, but that one moment where you look at it and he did what? You look at this, you watch your TV screen, like the broadcasters who are LA Dodgers are broadcasting from Dodger Stadium to that game, or buying the broadcasters in their homes, actually, because they're not allowed at Dodger Stadium because there's a game going on. So Charlie Stein is probably broadcasting in his living room, and he just, the air is saved for that home.
Everyone, you know, freaks out. Even my friend who was actually on this podcast, Noah, big Dodgers fan, he immediately called me and just was jaw dropped by how Bellinger caught that ball. He just robbed him.
That was an incredible catch. And I'll say one other thing about the Dodgers that was really just quite good throughout all of this is the game Smith had. 5 hits in a game. Great.
Right. The first 5-hit, right? In Dodger history.
5 hits in a game. It's the first time ever for a Dodgers, I would hope for a Dodgers catcher, but at least a Dodgers player. I mean, that was so important to them just to get all those hits when you need.
And if you even look at game 3, right? When they were coming back, when they were down by 1, the 6 runs, they were done by not home runs, but bunch of singles and doubles.
That's an incredible, that's a good feat to note too. Is can the Dodgers hold their power back? Can they play small ball? And they did. They did quite well. And the other side, the Padres,
Austin Nola, also former Mariner. He had some clutch hits, and that's about it.
I mean, in the game where they need the home runs, they got some home runs. The Manny Machado thing with the home run with
Mookie Betts, right? Yeah.
More tension between those two,
and that's probably coming from the Red Sox Oriole day. To be fair, so you know
that's right.
The history.
That's true. They have a double history. They have like they're both rivals in that setting, and now they're rivals in this setting. It just, the series showed simply that the Dodgers are a force to be reckoned with.
And Padres, great talent, great year. But you just, Dodgers just had that big brother, complex and mentality. So they would not let the Padres come by. Can't let the little brother surpass him.
The Padres kind of showed, we talked about experience last time.
Right.
The inexperience of the Padres as a total unit, not as a, on the team, they have some very experienced players. Tommy Pham, Eric Hosmer, Manny Machado, experienced players. But as a unit, to go into this new setting and play against the Dodgers, do we see something there? I don't know, but I think there was a telling fact that, like you said, the Dodgers are the same unit that we expected to walk into the field and just play the game, and they did. Granted, their pitching was a little bit just different from what we expected.
Gratterall, Trinan, I mean, they're probably the key, but we could, they're probably the key for the bullpen, but you're right in terms of unit. They have at least 4 years head start over these guys. They've been in the playoffs like almost every year. And, you know, Corey Seager was a rookie, a call up in August and was in the 2015 postseason. So they just know what to do.
There was an interesting discussion about the Padres got to playoffs too early in their like rebuilding process. I think that's kind of true. Next year, or the season's going forward, will they have Mike Clevinger back healthy? Is a quick question. Second question, will they add any more pieces? We know that Trevor Bauer tweets about, I'm going to Houston, I'm going this team. Like a player like that caliber going to another. I mean, they've each year they've now kept adding players. Like Manny Machado was one. They added Eric Hosmer, Mitch Moreland, more dependable veteran players. They added Clevinger this year. What's going to happen to the Padres going forward? Because they were ahead of their time. I will agree to that fact. I think they were ahead of their time just enough to say, we made it to the division series. Now what? I mean, they're sad to go home because they got routed in right. the end.
But they do have a promising future, and they still have one of the best farm systems in the league. So they could still build off of their success now and add more pieces and call up guys, and you have a formidable rotation. Like, we still haven't seen the call up of major key like pitching prospects that they have. So like, we don't know yet.
The essence of the topic is simply, how are teams building a rotation? We saw how the Padres built a rotation by a little bit of acquisition and a little bit of from their own farm system. When they got Austin Hill, they sold off some of their farm players who were batters. They got some little more pitchers. They got Altavilla, who's a good backup, back-end rotation guy.
He throws 100 miles, yep. Right,
back-end bullpen type of player. And they have Rosenthal. They got Zach Williams. Williams. And then they have, obviously, Mike Clevinger at the top. What's going to come of that team? Because if you look at all the other teams and kind of how their rotations and bullpens are set up, they're pretty much kind of static-ish enough. But the Padres have the most volatility. What we can do this. Because they threw so many bullpen games in the first round of the playoffs, and then they got with this. That's how I look at it. We wrapped up the two sweeps. We brought the brooms out in Texas for both of those.
Now we're going back to sunny California. Let's start off with the one that we thought would have the big beef and that ended up not being that fun to watch, which is the Astros-A's series. Oh, man. The A's, again, choked.
The A's did not do as they will. I was surprised on home runs in this series. I was underestimating the dry, warm air of Los Angeles.
Day game. Just day pushes.
Games, all day games. You're a good point. All, I think they were all noon starts local.
Yeah.
It was hot. It was definitely a factor. As we talk through this, I've been looking through the box scores for this game. I feel like the A's didn't get any runs except for home runs. They didn't produce any runs by anything but the home run.
Yep,
and that's not their style. That is not A's baseball. Just without Matt Chapman, you have to score runs other ways. And doesn't look like they really did that.
Right. They just relied on the long ball and they did not hit in key situations, especially runners in scoring positions. I don't know the entire stat, but they left a lot of men on base.
In game one, they left 13 batters on base. That was the game they scored 5 runs.
And Springer went nuts.
Right. The other thing that I point out to you during the week, there was a stat that was brought up in the Oakland A's broadcast from Ken Korak, he stated that up until the sixth inning, they were playing great. And then after the sixth inning, they couldn't hit, they couldn't score, they couldn't do anything. They're batting sub 100 in like beyond this in the latter third of the game. That's not a playoff, man. They can have that happen. The playoffs against a team that can hit home runs like at will from that team. These games are all really high scoring too. So if you lost, you're out. I mean, 10-5 Astros game one, 5-2 Astros game two. The Athletics somehow turned it around in game three, 9-7. And then 11-6 Astros in game four. It's not A's baseball. A's baseball is not keep the score running up. Let's keep the score running down. Keep the score very low.
And that's where we've got to bring up the biggest issue for this series was their pitching, especially that bullpen did not hold up, especially Dekman, Soria. They gave up at least two runs every time they came out.
That is absolutely a point that we talked about during the week. The A's bullpen was dependable. The A's bullpen was not dependable, not reliable. No starter lasted up to five innings.
Right. I mean, we expected that. We weren't expecting them to go deep, and they didn't. But the disappointment was, the bullpen carry it? No, they didn't. The only dependable guy from that whole bullpen was Liam Hendricks, and he had to pitch three innings in game three just to secure that do or die game for them.
Just look at these box scores with the home runs. That's not how the A's are going to win games. I brought that up earlier. They pretty much on the same lap every game, but their starters barely lasted as long as they could. The bullpen for the Houston Astros pitched well when they needed to.
They still gave up runs. I think I would say it's a young starters, not Greinke, but Framber Valdez and Christian Javier.
Very vital in game four. Two and a third, three hits, four strikeouts. After Zach Greinke had a rough go at the start, Carlos Correa hit way too many home runs in this series. He had way too many RBIs.
Springer, Altuve also, the magical gnome just came back and hit the ball like he did last year.
Michael Brantley had two home runs in the final game of the series. We did it. We knew the Astros could hit home runs. We didn't know they could hit that many home runs.
And score that many all at once. It's as if they were like on vengeance mode. They just hated the A's and they just wanted to smack them back home. And they
did that. That's what they did. There was a couple news postings about where was Mike Fiers? And Mike Fiers never saw the field. And we had thought Mike Fiers was destined to be in this game. So it'd be a question that's going to be asked a lot about. We talk about the theme of this week is pitching management and questions about pitching. Why wasn't Mike Fiers brought out? Mike Fiers is a starter. He was great. They used Mike Minor a lot. Mike Minor could have came in there and started the game if he really needed to. He didn't.
And then they just forced Frankie Montas, who's been struggling, to start game four. And, he gave up a lot of runs.
Between Montas and Wendelken, three home runs. Seven earned runs in just about four in about three and four innings.
Yep.
It's not going to win a ball game.
Yep. You can't do that.
No. So goodness gracious, this series was just an explosion of home runs, an explosion of just runs.
And now the explosion of the Astros. Now they're back. We don't know what to expect from them now.
It's like how much of that ferocity and just the, I hate calling it the victim card, but they're playing like they're the, it's like everyone hates us. We're going to play like we're the hated group. And they really are playing like the hated group because they are playing with a evil spirit within them. Like Carlos Correa, the emotion on his face when he hit that home run, he just chucks the bat away. I mean, that was something like the KBO. That's beyond KBO bat flips.
Right.
The KBO bat flips a little more fun, a little more exciting. And that was just, he took the bat and just threw it. And the primal scream of he just let out when he hit that home run. They were out for blood. I mean, that's the best way you can put it. And they did it. And
they just proved the point.
Now we move to the series that you have lots of opinions on. I have my own opinions on.
And
the one that went all the way
to game
in San Diego,
game five, we expected.
Yankees Rays. I will say as a note of I politely asked last week to be nice to the warehouse. They were not. There was a lot of home runs hit to that beautiful Western Supply warehouse, and it was a little bit too close for my comfort, just as a thing. But I leave the floor to you to open on this series. There are lots of talking points, but there's one that I know you have something to say about.
Okay, well, let's start off with the positives, and that's what I'm going to talk about the Rays was. They managed the bullpen very, 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 very well. And they knew when to use the right guys at the right time. And you could see that from game five, bringing in their closer, Nick Anderson, in the middle of the third inning to relieve Tyler Glasnow. And he threw almost three innings. And then they already had the matchups ready. If Nick Anderson's done, then Fairbanks is in. And they knew they had to finish with Diego Castillo. So positive, their bullpen, just dominant, filthy. And these were a lot of misfits, you know, like a lot of players who were just DFA'd from different teams. And Tampa found a way to revitalize their career. And now they're a machine to be reckoned with. They're just amazing. And they're hitting. It's not really their regular starters. It's their pinch hitters. They knew how to play matchup against Aaron Boone and the Yankees. And they just outmatched it. Russo, another misfit toy. He just knows how to hit in clutch situations against lefties. And he had an OPS of 900 this year against lefties. So you had your lefty smasher. That's where the positive. And for the Yankees, Giancarlo looks kind of back. At least he was able to hit in playoffs. Garrett Cole's amazing. And he showed why he was a $300 million man for a reason. And the rest, should we go into the bad stuff?
I'll give you a couple of highlights I thought of. The play of G-Man Troy against Garrett Cole, like that matchup was just really fun to watch just because like every broadcaster was like G-Man Troy against Garrett Cole is like the matchup. And then we'll get into like the other bad stuff. The Brasso Chapman head to head that started this year with like the hit by pitch at Yankee Stadium. And then the 10 pitch rally at bat this last night on Friday night. On that 10th pitch, you could just hear, it was like, it's going to, if he hits it, it's going to explode. And it exploded. That home run was like fireworks in the eighth. It was fireworks in the eighth inning. It was done for them. Another bright spot. Austin Meadows, I was concerned with him coming back earlier in the series. And then game five, he hits a very, the important home run. I will talk about the attempted catch from Aaron Judge. These are a lot of talking points about like what happened when Aaron Judge went to go back to the ball on that one versus the Cody Bellinger play. And I'll compare those two later on. It was that home run was you needed it. You really needed it in the fifth inning and you got it.
And Garrett Cole did not give up a hit
except for that
until that. Exactly.
That broke up everything for him. And then throughout the series, the bullpen of the Rays, we've praised them to the nth of all. But these games, none of the games were utterly out of hand, except game one a little bit.
Well, that's because they threw Curtis for 40 like pitches and he was pretty much done. But Rays just forced it because they didn't want to bring out other bullpen arms and tire them out because this whole new format, there's no like rest days. So they had to be very wise about how they use their bullpen. And Curtis was left to die and Giancarlo hit a grand slam and Curtis was going to be dead and he did not come back.
The other bright spot for the Rays in the batting cycle is Randy Arozarena.
What a pickup.
What a pickup. That was, I mean, he started off this series so well. So good. So good. And like you said, the Island of Misfit Toys of his random plays you never got to hear about, never heard about. And he just played so well when they needed him to. And that was such a bright story for this team. Because like you said, like we've talked about the Rays in particular, and the Braves are a little bit like this, but Rays have some like more star power. But when you have the Rays lineup, if you don't have the top of your order kind of hitting as what you did, you can kind of like Miller, can you fill in? Can the bottom order? So you talk about the Braves, how they can do that too. But Randy Arozarena, was not like the hitter you thought would he could do this. And he came up so large in those games where we need hits. Randy Rosarena is going to come up. Because everyone was joking. It's like the broadcast on I listened to the Rays radio network, the Yankees radio network, then the ESPN radio national broadcast. Everyone was head over heels for Randy Rosarena after the first couple of games. And that makes me very happy. As we look at role players, their important role in the future going forward, I'll bring it back and akin to this from another sport later on. You need players like that outside your stars to do well. He's not a star. And he did such a nice job of holding the line when they needed in the batting lineup. Because I brought G-Man Choi, the G-Man Choi, Garrett Cole rivalry is something that's wow. But Randy Rosarena, just great stuff. And that's kind of where I want to stop with the good stuff for now, because there is a story to be told with Aaron Boone. And I know you sent me a message during the week about I got thoughts. So I see the floor to you about what happened with Aaron Boone and the nature of that just management of the team when they needed it most.
All right. Well, let's start off as a nasty part. Aaron Boone, he just needs to get fired. After all that talent, in the past few years, he needs to go because of the way he mishandled everything, especially the bullpen in game two. You have Davey Garcia as your game two starter. We expected him to at least go three innings, and he knew going in this whole series there was no any rest days. They had to go all the way, and you knew that the bullpen was already scarce in who you could rely on. So you can't go back to the main three guys over and over again. And you knew that was going to be bad in the long run. And Davey Garcia only gave up that one home run to Randy Rosarena. And after that, it wasn't that bad. Next thing you know, you bring in J.A. Happ, who actually struggled the entire season except for two starts, and the postseason wasn't that great. And he knew he was not in for that whole bulking opener game. And he brought him in and he just let the game go away. And after that, I just can't speak of who he starts, how he builds lineup. And that was a mess. So after game one, his management was just god awful that, you're just tiring out your key bullpen arm, and you're using guys who has no experience in high leverage situation and let them pitch in high leverage situation. Jonathan Loaisiga shouldn't be pitching in key moment where you're down by one. He shouldn't be pitching in that moment. You got to bring in guys who are experienced in going in, like a Zach Britton or even like Adam Ottavino, who has been struggling this season. He's like the guy you would bring in, and you don't bring those guys. You let a rookie to let him die, and you bring, and sure, it's great to have young guys get experience, but you don't bring them in key winning situations. You should have done that in the regular season. And that's how the Rays kind of prepped all of their guys, because they knew when to come in and they close, they come in key high leverage situations. So that's why when they go into the playoffs, they know how to pitch. But Yankees, you already have a formula with Green, Britton, and Chapman, that when all those other guys who are supposed to be a swingman or a mop-up guy coming in the key situation, they won't perform because they've never been in that situation. How stupid is that? And on top of that, we're talking about a lineup who should have been privy to, who should have known the past few years how to hit in key situations. But oh man, did they just swing for the fences. They just, you could look at it in every at bat, they just wanted to be a hero and try to hit a home run. And in a playoff, that never works against really good pitching. You can't just aim for home runs. Home runs don't happen every single time. You strike out in key situations and bases loaded. Luke Voit, I'm looking at you. You blew up. You freaking screwed up in a game that you should have scored. You try to swing for the fences. No one needs a grand slam. What puts pressures in these pitchers are base hits. You could have looked at the LA Padres series. Dodgers did the same thing, where they just hit singles and singles and singles. That put a lot of pressure on them. And guess what? The Yankees failed to do that. And they just wanted to be a hero and try to hit a home run. The only guys you need them to do is, the Yankees need is Stanton and Judge. That's the two guys you just need to rely on for home runs. The rest of the guys should have just been hitting for contact and be like DJ LeMahieu in hidden key situations and not screw it up. And one last negative note, I would say, besides, you know, starting pitching being lackluster outside of Gerrit Cole, I mean, before I go into the management's issue, Gary freaking Sanchez, why do you start Gary freaking Sanchez? He has been the worst hitter this whole freaking season, who just can't catch up on those high 95 miles per hour fastball. And on top of that, you've known he's one of the worst catcher on earth. Like, yes, the underlying statistics could show that, you know, that he might be okay and decent, but the eye test, he looks horrible. Like, he can't block pitches off the dirt. None of his pitchers could even trust him. Look, even Gerrit Cole, your ace, doesn't even trust him to a point that he just goes to the backup catcher to be his personal catcher to start. And after that, like, you know, Kyle Higashioka, very smart guy who would have gone to Berkeley if he wasn't drafted. Like, that was the right choice from game three and on, like, where you start him. But you freaking pinch hit him. Top the eighth from Mike Ford, who has not hit anything this season. And then he had to bring in Gary Sanchez to catch because there's no other catcher besides Kyle Higashioka being out. So you have Gary Sanchez. And you knew once he came in game five at the bottom of the eighth that it wasn't going to work well because Gary cannot frame a pitch, cannot frame a strike. And that one strike, getting the strike call, is important to pitchers because it changes the whole count in a dynamic of the game. And, you know, Brasseau just got the best of it from there. So I just think Gary needs to go. Like, he is not your catcher. He can't hit anything. He can't play defense. And if he can't block anything in the dirt, how can your pitchers trust him to pitch anything? And because, like, if you look at game three and game four, at least game four, when he had Kyle Higashioka catching, at least the pitchers were dominant. Chad Green, Britton, Chapman, they did not give up a hit or a base runner. They were so filthy because they could trust that catcher. Like, they could pitch anything in the dirt and they know that nothing will go wrong. And if you look at, like, even game one, mix up in bases loaded was Gerrit Cole and Higgy, right? He still caught the ball, and, you know, if he didn't catch the ball, that would have been a tie game. And you got to have a catcher. You can't have a catcher who just hits all or nothing. You got to have a catcher who plays very good defense and could catch a freaking ball and frame it. And people may not notice, and even in, like, our fourth softball, I'm known to be the biggest framer in softball, and that actually helps in key games.
That's an understatement right there. As our dear friend Stephanie will tell all of us, you try really hard and she gets really pissed off sometimes. But she does, you and her do a great job. You're not the best tandem on our team, by the way. We still know who the best battery is. But that was an interesting frame you brought up with that. Because I was watching, like, the Gary Sanchez dynamic became like a storyline. Like, that should not be a storyline. The Gary Sanchez thing is like, you play him or you don't. And they inserted him in ways where he kind of became the story. And that's not Yankees baseball. And I get the whole call for the head of Aaron Boone kind of mentality, because this roster is no reason why you should get X'd out anywhere. The interesting thing with the Yankees, I will say that the pitching thing that surprised me was a Jordan Montgomery story in that game where he came in. I did not expect him to pitch.
Pitch solid game, yeah. Four innings,
two innings, and they got a win when they needed a win. But yeah, certain games show just the game two. J.A. Happ, like, what? The J.A. Happ thing with David Garcia, I was like, what? Why is this going on? And then you just burn more bullpen after that. That game was a wipeout. That game,
they could have not. It was close though. They were down by three or two. If those runs did not come, Yankees could have won game two. And of course, Booney has to screw everything up. And, you know, we could call for his head, but I doubt they'll do anything. They're too complacent on that. I think there just needs to be a change in strategy, how, you know, what kind of talent you bring in. And I think it comes from the offseason. This past offseason, you just brought one guy in, which was Gerrit Cole, and they thought they were done and they shouldn't have been done. You knew that this whole team was a very injury prone team. You knew they were going to get injured, and he had all these guys who were going down and did not grab extra depth. Like, I think the series would have been different if they had Cole, Tanaka, Severino, and Paxton in that series, a way different series, but you don't have two of those big guys. And then Domingo Germán is also gone. So like you only have two starters and maybe Davey Garcia, who's too young to be in the series. And the rest are like, what are these pieces? Like, what are you doing with them? And what a mismanagement from even the general management side. Like, I know Grant Brian Cashman, I praised him before. Like, he brought in great pieces like Gio Urshela, very underlying pieces that you don't expect them to do. DJ LeMay, he used the steal of the century for free agency, and you just don't add more pieces. And the other part I think has been an issue is the defense. Besides Gary, another issue, Gleyber Torres. He should not play shortstop. He's a second baseman. And it just showed in this whole season that you need a great shortstop for defense and key for winning. And you just knew that Didi Gregorius did a fantastic job, and we could feel how much we miss him.
Well, most important Yankee shortstop in recent history is now in the front office in the Florida Marlins, in the Miami Marlins, sorry. And then Didi Gregorius obviously is now on the Philadelphia Phillies. I get that. I really do. Luke Voit did not show up before. We didn't need him to show up. He, like you said, he does not swing on the ball the right way, the right times. That was not good. But now I think it's interesting time. I'll bring up the Aaron Judge play where everyone was kind of like, what happened on the Austin Meadows home run game 5? This is based on my imagination of watching kind of game tapes on film. You compare the Cody Bellinger home run and the Aaron Judge non-grab. First of all, there's the setting of Bellinger turns and is facing the fence, and there's nothing behind that. It's a padded wall in deep center in Texas, and you have a black space. There's an open gap there. So he can run, hit the padded wall, and go over. So he spun around, stuck out his glove, leaned with his glove, and went out there. Aaron Judge turned and started like tracking like a fly ball because it looked like a fly ball. So the depth, that part of the ballpark was not that big. But what he also noticed was he got too close. If he would have started his leap about a foot to 2 feet earlier with his height, he could have out-jumped that caged electronic wall and maybe had a shot at it. I'm not sure he would have caught it. But everyone's like, why did Aaron Judge just stop at the wall? And I think he said like, there are these plays in this game and there's management mishaps and there's just simple playing mishaps. It just doomed the Yankees from the start. Like this, oh no, like that was not good. I mean, Austin Meadows hit a home run. He hit a home run earlier in the series too. You got to deal with it. And the Yankees did not come. They couldn't beat the bullpen in game 5. That was the problem. But that I noticed the comparisons that were being made about these two different types of outfield plays. And I can only speak from my own experience. The Aaron Judge play is hard. It is much harder to actually field the ball because you think it's a fly ball. So you back to the fence and then you hit the fence. And you're like, I either have to go run back to make a play versus Cody Bellinger. He just played like a home run from the start. It's like that ball's going over the fence.
Right.
I got to fly. And he flew as far as he could. And we saw Kyle Lewis do it. I saw Kyle Lewis with the Mariners this year against the Oakland A's. We all remember the Griffey catch where he literally just, I don't know where his hand goes, but the ball just like appears and disappears. Plays like that are incredible when they happen. When they don't and they go the wrong way, they're just defeating. And I think that
turns the tide of the game. Yeah.
So that really hurt them. Now the Yankees are out. What will the Yankees do in the offseason? We have no idea. You set out a pretty strong plan of, way to get, can you move Sanchez? Can you get another player in there? Because relying on just having good pitching is not going to do it. Hopefully they get Paxton back. Hopefully they get Severino back in good health. And
right. Like you could have Gerrit Cole. Like, you know, he's the most reliable guy. And after that, you have Tanaka, Paxton, free agency. Severino is just coming back from a Tommy John. Germán is coming back from a suspension. And who knows like what those guys will have. And then what I think the key that they were missing last year, that was working last year was Tommy Kahnle. Not having that one strong bullpen arm hurt them. Like last year, even though the starting roster went completely down, right? The reason why they were winning so many games was because that bullpen was dominant throughout the year. Kahnle, Ottavino, Chapman, Britton, like even without Betances, they did well because they had Kahnle. This year, no Kahnle. They don't have a replacement for Kahnle. Like, what are you going to do? And Chad Green can't pitch forever. And it kind of showed in all of these games that Chad Green is vulnerable. Like he can't be like overextended. Like he's going to be fatigued and tired out. there are a lot of things I think Yankees should do. Personally, if I were the Yankees, I would start trading a lot, retooling and trading a lot of pieces. I mean, they could still win. I think they just need to, they don't have enough salary like right now. Like just the cap is too limited because of Gerrit Cole signing. So, and Giancarlo Stanton, obviously. But I think the main part they should think about is how to add more pitching, both bullpen and starting pitching, supplement that. They should bring a shortstop. They should move Gleyber back to second base where he was great at. Bring back DJ LeMahieu for sure. I think they should start trading a couple pieces. So Sanchez is one. I think even though this player had a very amazing year this year, Luke Voit should be traded now. I think his value is very high. You could get a net of starting pitching or some sort of good prospect or something. And as I hate to say this, I think it might be time to trade Aaron Judge.
That's blasphemy. You are disavowing the court. You're disavowing the court, man.
Look, Judge is amazing. I love Judge, but we already have the same player in Giancarlo Stanton, and his value he'll be more expensive by next year. He'll make at least $17 million. He's a great player, but he's also injured a lot, and you're not going to be able to sign him to a long-term deal knowing that he's going to be injured more in the future. So why not trade him while the value is high and get more like pieces? And like, if you look at the Rays, right, you don't need like powerhouse everywhere. You just need good players that could, you know, supplant like anything and be consistent. And that's what the Yankees need, consistency.
You hear that, Mariners? Aaron Judge needs to be traded. And we have a great, great setup there. He hit tons of home runs. Just Seattle Mariners, if you're willing to make some really raw deal right now, go trade for Aaron Judge. Okay, on that note, we conclude our thoughts on the division series and we move to the championship series.
Yes.
We have revisits of old battles past and old and new battles, so to speak. Do you want to start with Braves Dodgers or do you want to start with Astros? Astros Yankees is a whole. The whole Astros bring a lot of feeling, a lot of emotion.
But Astros Rays, that had the same feeling from last. They were facing each other in division series, so that'll be interesting. Let's talk about the Braves Dodgers because that's way more straightforward. And before we do that, let's talk about the key difference for this LCS and the different key factors. So I think the key factor so far is that during the bubble still, and it's just correct, in two stadium, San Diego and Arlington.
There is, so it was, we talked about the fields last time in our preview to the division series, but now we look at the fields, look at the teams that are going to be there. Tampa Bay has the advantage; they played there before, most recently. But Houston played there during the year. They're an AL West team. AL West played NL West, so they play there. They're familiar with that setting, which is good. If the home run bashing craziness continues, but
it's unlikely because it's a night game now. So.
Right. And as Mario Rivera in several very smart broadcasts brought up, the marine layer in San Diego only appears at night. So that dense makes the air a little more dense. And so it's harder to hit home runs. That's your weather report today brought to you by Brian Beiser. And then we go to Arlington. We have our domed brand new spanking ballpark. I believe there'll be a little bit of fans-ish. Maybe I thought 11,000 at the first report, but that may have changed. And we have one very clear notion. The Atlanta Braves have never played in that ballpark. Ever. There is no connection. That may have happened in previous, like in the World Series, but they have no connection to that ballpark at all. And that is as we saw, a confusing little ballpark sometimes, just kind of figuring out how things go. Also, I noticed like the lighting is kind of strange. It looks dark.
Feels like the Japanese stadium, like Tokyo Dome-ish. It's kind of
feels very Tokyo Dome-ish. That's a good way of putting it. So there's that. They're both in the bubble. The game, there's a very long break. Very long break to play with here. The Dodgers and the Braves both finished their games on Thursday. They will not play again until Monday. ALCS starts Sunday the 11th. Does that mean anything? I don't know. That puts the Rays at a slight disadvantage in terms of like timing and whatever. But it goes dome to dome, open air, the weather significant change from LA San Diego, but that's about it. But this is the last game in the bubble in California, last series in the bubble in California, because after this, the winner will move to Arlington to play the World Series at Globe Life. And that kind of where we stand. To preview these games, and you said, well, we'll start with the games that are going to continue to be in Texas with the Braves and the Dodgers. This is an interesting match, and I will say, from the strength pitching perspective, can you still bank on the rookies for the Braves? Because that's the first question I have. And then on the hitting side for the Braves, I'll advocate for the Braves and let you speak on the Dodgers. How much more Swanson can you take? How much more Swanson do you need? How much more Travis d'Arnaud can you dig? Can you depend on? Because that lineup is, and this is where I'll make my analogy to something I saw earlier this week. Kazuki knows that I'm a fan of several important teams bringing back from Seattle. And we lost our Supersonics. We gained the Seattle Storm, our WNBA team, and they won the championship this year. That team is built on 3 first-round draft picks. Seattle Storm, Brianna Stewart, Jewel Lloyd, Sue Bird, legendary players. Throughout the series in the game, like, one player would drop off, somebody had to step up. There was a fourth player named Aisha Clark. Aisha Clark came in and scored when she needed to score, and was one of the best defenders. Who is the Braves' Aisha Clark? Who is that player who's going to step up and is like, okay, Freeman, Ozuna, and Acuna Jr. are not having a good day. Who is going to be that fourth player that says, I can do it? In the last series, it was Travis d'Arnaud, Dansby Swanson. Great. You stepped up. Dansby Swanson's an eight-hole hitter. It's like, you can't rely on your eight-hole hitter all the time to do it. Travis d'Arnaud bats higher in the lineup, so we hope that he's going to be your hitter that's going to step up when you need him to, because we all know the Dodgers were going to put up runs. They're going to force you to make decisions that are tough and difficult. But that's where I stand on the Braves. Is who's going to be my fourth hitter? Because we saw in the last round, it's d'Arnaud, Swanson. Because other players were not having a good series. I hope Freddie Freeman plays to his potential. Because I know Acuna Jr. is going to just be off the rails good if he can do it. I was seeing with Ozuna. But Freddie
Freeman... They've been cold, though, in the postseason, right, both them.
If Freddie Freeman is my guy, get him in, get him playing well. And you don't have to, like, put all the weight on a d'Arnaud or a Swanson to really push yourself, because you already know you're putting yourself in that bullpen. That bullpen's going to be just taxed against that team. But that's my Braves preview. And I'll let you preview the Dodgers, because they're two different philosophies, it looks like, between these two teams.
Right. Dodgers, I think, comes from their Rays philosophy. It is Rays because Andrew Friedman was a former Rays baseball operations guy, now running the Dodgers. Very similar to Rays, top to bottom. It's not just star power. They're just very good. Like, everyone is consistent. They could do damage from anywhere they want. Key weakness we got to look at is the Dodgers starting pitching and their ninth inning hole. Those are the twos we need to really focus on. Starting pitching, Kershaw, he's been great. Can he continue that? Like, will his postseason nightmare happen again, or will he continue his postseason success that he's having so far this year? Walker Buehler, can he stay healthy and pitch deeper into games than he has recently? And then, who are your game three and game 4 starters? Are you playing a bullpen game? Are you bringing in Dustin May? Is he going to pitch a full 5 inning, or is he just going to be an opener or a relief arm? Is Urias the same thing? Is he a bulk guy? Or when is Tony Gonsolin actually pitching? The biggest, I think, problem with the Dodgers right now is their ninth inning hole. Kenley Jansen has been struggling the past 2 series. Postseason series, and he gives up a lot of runs, and the only reason why they won were because they were ahead by a certain amount and they had to bring it in. So who's going to replace him? And if you do replace him, will that ruin the whole bullpen workflow and chemistry, like, that they already built up? Will bringing in Trinan Gratterolf the ninth inning fix that hole, or would that ruin the rhythm of the entire other bullpen, like Floro? We're talking about, you know, Kolarik, like all these random arms that could come in, right? Like, how are you going to mix and match that if Jansen's having trouble, or are we going to stick to Jansen staying in ninth so that you don't ruin the rest of the flow of the bullpen, and hope to God that Jansen will be covering? And I think the other question is, like, if Jansen does struggle, are you going to put Kelly in, which they have in the game 2 series? And that doesn't look good either, because it's Kelly is a hit or miss. He's very good postseason pitcher, but he walks a lot of guys and walks are not good. So that is the tough weakness part, but the strength, who are you going to rely on? Like, so far, Mookie Betts has been the guy who's been carrying everything, as well as Corey Seager and Will Smith. So these three guys have been carrying everything. Will Max Muncy or even Cody Bellinger step up on the plate? Or are you going to rely on other guys like AJ Pollock to actually carry more RBI situations? Like, who are your like heroes this time? Then if they could play like they are right now, where Mookie like is a table setter and coming in on base and someone knocks him in, I think they have a very good success of beating this very strong Braves pitching core.
I couldn't agree with you more about the Dodgers pitching staff. We know how talented they are individually. When you get to that ninth inning, and we've gone back and forth about what do you do with Kenley Jansen, because we saw what happened last year's prior, and that's very tough to do that. The hitting, the hitting and the fielding for the Dodgers is, in my opinion, the best remaining lineup left of any of the four teams in any of the championship series. I guess this is prediction time. It's like, how are we going to see this out? I'm going to go Dodgers in six. I have a strange feeling that the Dodgers are going to blow a game like a really unfortunate way. And that will set them off for maybe one or for two games. I just think when you look at the recovery of whoever loses, who's going to come back and recover. The Braves haven't had to worry about recovering much this year. And with the same with the Dodgers. But the Dodgers had their best players play a down year set and still do quite well.
And that's it, thanks to one superstar who just likes to constantly win, which is Mookie Betts. Like, what an acquisition. Like, whenever a star player comes to another team, they usually have a down year, but no, not for Mookie. Mookie wants to win again. Like, usually if you have a ring, they don't really care about winning another ring. You already have one, but not for Mookie. Like, Mookie is a driven, and I think he's one of the hearts of that clubhouse, and he's leading them to this championship. So I agree. Dodgers in six, too.
We both do agree, though. The Braves have the potential to really make a mark and potentially even upset them to a certain degree. I think the Braves can do it early on with Max Fried and Ian Anderson really do it. They could take a 2-0 lead.
They could, but I think the problem now that they're facing, they're facing a very patient lineup. These guys will take a lot of pitches, will walk, and does not swing at pitches outside the zone. Their zone swing are completely low in terms of anything outside the zone. So, right. And then in the first two teams they faced are guys, our teams that will swing at anything. Like, the Marlins team is very young, not patient. They'll hack at any pitch. Reds, very known to be volatile and swing at anything. So that's going to be a challenge for them because they have not faced an opposition that could actually be patient and wear you down and raise that pitch count up and then attack you once like they see that you're weakening.
That pitch count argument is important. I don't expect the Braves to allow Fried, Anderson, Wright, those players to go big, deep pitch counts. They pitch usually 5, 6, 7 innings, which is great for the playoffs. But to keep going that deep on all these things, luckily they have some rest, so they can build them up a little bit. But that could do them in too. It's like you can't, like, the Braves strategy, the Rays bullpen strategy works for that type of team. The Braves are kind of like that. It did not work for the A's, the Yankees, and a lot of other teams throughout the year and the postseason. Like, you try to we'll just throw an opener and then we'll just stack our bullpen. Well, if your bullpen falls apart.
Yeah, you don't have anything else to go with. Right.
You're just going to lose. And we already know that the Dodgers can runs any which way. We'll hit five home runs. We'll hit five runs. We'll hit 12 singles and score runs. And it doesn't matter to them. Interesting series. Both agree. Dodgers in six. We shift our attention to Petco Park and my beloved Western Supply Company warehouse to the Rays and the Astros. I'll take the Astros, as much as I am a very disheartened Astros previewer over here.
I'll give the Rays preview then.
Yeah, so the Astros showed us the might of mites when they just hit home runs all the time in that series. So the thing that I will say about the Astros is the how possible is it to repeat your home run strength from games prior? I don't know, but we know they can do it. Correa is hot both in his batting and in his attitude. So that's covered. Altuve's coming back. Michael Brantley, Josh Reddick with these crazy catches in right field. Like, great, cool. Like, they have all the pieces to do it. George Springer came off and did. George Springer has a great year. George Springer is also a contract year, so he gone, I hope. He way gone after this season. The pitching is a little bit of a concern for me. And I'll say this. I forgot to mention Lance McCullers Jr. in our preview to the division series. He is a great pitcher. When he is on, he is great. Like, to have when it was Cole, Verlander, McCullers, yikes, that was great stat. You're listening, you got two of those guys out. You're on McCullers and Greinke. And like you said, you're kind of mixing and matching pieces at the other end of the spectrum. If Greinke can perform better and McCullers can pitch better, that's two solid starters. I just don't – that's my question. That's two solid starts. How many games got to win now? Got to win four. Got to win four games now, not three, four. And this is not like we talk about Whitey Ford and Bob Gibson. They could go 1-4-7. They're not doing 1-4-7 anymore. They're not doing that.
And there's not enough rest to do that.
No. So that there's my concern. We know if the lineup is hot, it is hot, both again in batting and in attitude. Yikes. That was just ferocious what they did against the A's and what they've done all throughout their time as the bashers that they are. My concern with their batting, though, is the propensity to swing too hard and strike out, because the pitchers they are facing now, Morton came back. Glasnow is inserted as the number two. And then you got Blake Snell. And Blake Snell is crafty. They may have faced him before, but I don't care. This is Blake Snell versus the angry Astros. And that is my concerns. We know they're dependable pieces. Their bullpen was good, solid. They were good, satisfactory to good. The back, they didn't have to worry about anything like blowing up. They blew up in one game, the 9-7 game against the A's. That's it. Otherwise, it's just, it is what it is, and they move on. So there's your Astros preview. Again, you can ever detect my disdain for this team a little bit, my tone, but we stand pat with them, move on to the Rays.
All right, for the Rays preview, I would start off with their strength so far, the bullpen. Will that bullpen keep succeeding and will do well? They have their big four horsemen in Nick Anderson, Diego Castillo, Pete Parabanks, and then now in Ryan Thompson. Like, are those four guys going to continue to perform very well, throw 90 miles per hour against this home run happy Astros lineup? That's one. Number two is the starting pitching. Was Glasnow, Snell? Well, Glasnow was on 2 days rest, so he's not that rested coming in. And then now Blake Snell and Charlie Morton. So will those three guys perform against this Astros lineup? And they are all fatigued. And Morton just came off an injury and still like has his stuff, but not really. Like, he's so shaky. Blake Snell also could be kind of shaky in postseason situation, but he's more well rested. So will they hold up and pass baton to the bullpen? So those are the pitching we're looking at. And then will Yarbrough be able to bulk very well? But because they're at Petco, a pitcher-friendly park, and it's at nighttime, I think the home run, a lot of those pitchers are fly ball pitchers, but I don't think the ball will go out of the ballpark as much. So they have I like their chances against the Astros with that, because like the ball will be at least contained in the field and they have a very solid defense. So I'm not worried about that. The other part I think they need to get going is Brandon Lau, your MVP of that team. Will he get going? He is 1-4-12 right now. He has not hit anything in key situations. Will he go back to that August form where he'll be hitting a lot of dingers and knocking guys in? And your other key guys is, Randy Arozarena, Brasseau, And will Joey Wendell carry the baton? And obviously, Kevin Kiermaier, can they keep pushing and keep running on those Astros pitching? Like, how are they going to break it up and confuse the Astros and beat them up? And they do have experience against the Astros team from last year, so they know how to fight them and they know how to attack them. It's the same core, same hitters, just less pitching. So can the hitters actually get going, knock in runs, and not strike out too much? Because Rays are also kind of known to strike out too much. So can they put the ball in play like they did in the Yankee series? So that would be my preview of the Rays.
Prediction time. I'm going to be bold here. Not actually that bold. I'm going Rays in five. I think because if they get three games, if the Astros go behind two or three games, I think this series is over. And the Rays have that one extra pitcher that the Astros don't have. And we've talked about Valdez, and like, they're great. They're not Granky and they're not McCullers. It's like, and then you brought up Thompson. Again, the Thompson Yarborough combination. That's 5-6 innings. And then you can go to your Fairbanks, Castillo, Anderson line. It's like the greatest law firm that you can always secure. It's like, we'll lock you down. And like, they're great. That is an incredible group of pitchers to just go after. And I hope Randy Arozarena just goes absolutely insane again. Just give me all the hits, all home runs, all you want to do. Just go. So I'm going Rays in five. I think no game is a blowout except the one that the Astros win.
I think I'm going to go Rays in six. And here's why. I think we might be underestimating the Astros a little bit. Because we did under,
I just don't like.
I don't like. I don't like them either. But we underestimated them, you know, in the wild card, you know, series against the Twins and the A's. They have, like you said, I think the key to winning these series is, you know, as a unit, how much experience do you have with adversity? How can you fight? And Astros have a couple year experience over the Rays. The Rays are second year into this postseason, and as a collective group, they know what to go for and what to do. So there's an advantage for they have a little bit more experience. So there's a little bit more of fight going in, but Astros have a lot of that experience. But like the problem with Astros is, like you said, pitching lacks. So which is why I think Rays in six, but I think one weakness of the Rays that the Yankees forgot to exploit is pitching inside, like each, because I think of the whole Chapman like head incident. They were afraid to pitch inside, but for the Rays, they'll hit anything outside the zone. Like if you don't pitch inside, they're not going to be afraid to be in that batter's box. So you have to pitch inside against the Rays if you're going to try to win ball games.
That's true. And then we know how aggressive the Astros tend to be throughout their whole lineup. We talked about today significantly. That means that our prediction is a Dodgers-Rays World Series, which is kind of like David Goliath, very cliche, but it's also very different. It's like it's the big money versus the little money, the star versus the rising kind of thing, like for proven, not proven. So it's just, I think it's be exciting. This week's gonna be very exciting for baseball. I'm looking forward more to watching the Braves Dodgers series.
Yeah,
just because of the finesse in those lineups.
Right. It's a powerhouse lineup for sure. And I mean, we could expect a Friedman World Series because Rays Dodgers, both Andrew Friedman team built up together. So that's one thing to look at, but I don't know. I have this tingling feeling that maybe MLB doesn't want that. MLB wants the Astros Dodgers. That's my feeling.
The great tingling that tells you it's going to be,
they want that 27.
The enemies of enemies. If that series does happen, I will say I will take out an insurance policy at Globe Life Park because there's gonna be a lot of broken pads, broken doors, broken everything because everything's so angry at each other. Look, and please, Globe Life Park and Petco Park, let me ask you one thing. Please remove all trash receptacles from the dugout and please place them squarely on the field so everyone can see that they are not being used. It just harkens back to, like, it gives me like this like Like, I want them to play like very raucous rock music, to like just all this loud, like angry music. Just play the play heavy metal and just bring them all out and just play the game. But we're in for an exciting week of baseball. Best of seven now for the first time. I'm excited. And we could go as far as Sunday to Sunday. We predicted that most games would be over by Saturday, the 17th. So we'll see. We got done quicker this week than we expected. So we'll see what happens going forward.
That's it for this episode of Sayonara Baseball. Sayonara Baseball is hosted and produced by me, Kazuki Akiba, and Tara Hori.
Guest starring Brandon Beiser from Forza Beiser and the Airline Guy blog. Please check out his LinkedIn profile if you're looking for business intelligence help, as well as any advice on finance and air travel tips.
This episode was edited by Kazuki Akiba, with additional research and editing by Maria Tierney. Our theme song is by Kay Margus. Ray Laptop mixed this episode. Sayonara Baseball is a production of Daylight and Media 3 Limited. We'll be back with another episode. If you like this episode, please rate, review, and subscribe to our podcast, as more people will know about this show. Go to DaylightInteractive.com to see some exclusive updates and more about our upcoming shows. I'm Kazuki Akiba.
I'm Tara Hori.
And this has been Sayonara Baseball.